All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is a off-season Q&A. It's the beginning of June, so why not have a Q&A discussing what's going on with the Atlanta Falcons?
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon websites on the internet, and, of course, the host of this podcast. You can find me on Twitter, at FalcFans, where many of people submitted their questions for this Q&A, as well as Locked On Falcons, the show's Twitter handle. We've got some email questions, LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. Of course, Facebook, Locked On Falcons is that page, and, of course, some comments at LockedOnFalcons.com or FalcFans.com. So, in the future, if you want to get your questions answered on future episodes, then by all means, hit me up in those areas, on those platforms and whatnot, and we will get your questions answered. So let's kick things off talking with Steve Barnes at Steve Barnes 1978. He asks, looking around the league, we've been better than average at successful first round picks the past few years. Are we due for a bust, or is our scouting just that good? Probably we're due for a bust, but you certainly can look back over the last 5 to 7 years and say that the Falcons have been really good, particularly under Thomas Dimitroff, who's been here now for a decade. You know, eventually you're going to hit a bust. No one bats a thousand. You know, Ozzie Newsome probably had the longest run of really successful, particularly when you focus on first round picks. Run from 1996 to 2008, he had 15 first round picks in that period of time. 10 of those guys wound up being Pro Bowlers. 2 of them are currently Hall of Famers. Another one, Ed Reed, is probably going to be a Hall of Famer. And you could certainly make a case for Haloti Ngata joining him, and somebody else whose name escapes me at this current time might also be on that list of possible Hall of Famers as well. So, and then you look at the, 10 out of 15 were Pro Bowlers. Out of the 5 that weren't, 3 of those guys were guys that started for the Ravens for 4 or 5 in the case of Joe Flacco, 10 years with that team. So you're talking about a hit rate of 87%, I think, if 13 out of 15 is something like that. So that's ridiculously high. Now, since 2008, there had been a lot less success. They've only had 1 Pro Bowler in their last 7 first-round picks, a couple of solid starters, but they've had a lot more misses, a lot more quote-unquote busts like Matt Elam, Brashad Perryman. Prior to that period, you only really looked at Kyle Bowler as a bust. Maybe you could make a case that Mark Clayton was a bust, even though he was a decent NFL player, just probably didn't live up to his draft status. And when you bring it back to the Falcons, as I said, Dimitroff's hit rate is about 75% when you just look at 2008 to 2016 in the first round. If you add TAC to the mix, I think it pushes that up to about 80%. So you do have a really high hit rate. Is that sustainable over the next couple of years? Sure. Is that sustainable over the next decade? I don't think so. But I do think the Falcons could have a couple more successful first round picks over the next 2, 3, maybe even 4 years before we start to see a lot more misses in the mix. Only time will tell. That's basically the lesson I'm trying to say. Our next question comes from Christian Farholt. He asks, will the Falcons roll with 7 receivers and 4 tailbacks, and when will we get rid of Schaub? As far as the roster goes, anything really is possible when it comes to sort of how many players you keep at any given position, just because injuries do have a tendency to affect that. If you have a starter that's going to miss the first 2 weeks of the season, then you're going to carry an extra guy in your 53-man roster just to get you through those 2 weeks till that starter comes back, and then you might cut him. 7 wide receivers, 4 tailbacks probably won't be the case, but, Devontae Freeman has an ankle injury, Julio Jones has a wrist injury, all of a sudden that becomes a lot more possible. In talking about the 4 tailbacks in particular, I don't expect that even if guys really perform well this summer, just because you'll be carrying 2 rookies at the position and rookies aren't really necessarily going to contribute a ton. It's weird because when you give the ball to rookies, they're great. Rookie running backs I'm talking about. They're amazing with the ball in their hands because that's just natural to them. But the element I talked about this with the Ito Smith scouting report is the element that so many rookies struggle with is pass protection. And you like you look at a player like Alvin Kamara, who was amazing last year, you know, what, offensive rookie of the year, if I'm not mistaken. But you actually look at the percentage of snaps that he had last year on passing downs that involved him pass protecting. I could be wrong, but if he wasn't the lowest in the league, it was like in like the bottom three. Like he had like less than 5% of his snaps or something ridiculous like that on passing downs where he was asked to block somebody. And that's another indicator that, you know, rookies that may be able to make that transition to the league as far as being able to block and understand pass protection schemes is very rare, even from players like Alvin Kamara who had amazing years. And so I think with the keeping the four tailbacks and this assuming, you know, Ito Smith is the third and one of these undrafted rookies is the fourth guy, Justin Crawford, DeMario Richard, or Malik Williams, you're going to be putting a lot on, you know, you're going to basically either have to be absolutely in love with that guy's offensive potential and be like, there's no way we can let this guy go because he's going to be a superstar. Or you're going to have a prodigy when it comes to a guy that's, you know, a rare, rare sort of player that can be a competent pass protector. I think Malik Williams is ahead of the curve when it comes to rookie running backs, but I don't necessarily know if he's going to be the type of guy that you're going to expect to immediately come in and carve out roles that way. So specifically for four tailbacks, I think it's more likely that they'll keep three and keep another guy in a practice squad, but you never know. As for Schaub, you know, I think the chances of them getting rid of Schaub in the calendar year of 2018 are pretty much nil. I don't expect, you know, maybe it's possible if Schaub is just absolutely atrocious in the preseason, but I just don't see that happening. Unlike, say, everybody's folk hero like Chris Redman, who was not really that good, and that sort of bore out the longer he was in Atlanta. Schaub is a much more competent NFL quarterback. You know, is Schaub overpaid? Absolutely. Is he a necessary part of the team? You know, depends on what you define necessary, but probably not. You know, but we could certainly go down a slippery slope and start eliminating probably half the team if we wanted to really talk about who was worth their contract and who was a key part of the team. I think when you sort of, it's funny because when you look at the peak years of Matt Schaub in over his career from 2008 to 2012 and compare that to sort of the peak years of Matt Ryan prior to 2016, but from 2010 to 2014, Schaub and Matt Ryan were statistically at least pretty much equal in some statistics. Schaub was far outclassing Matt Ryan. And it's not to sit here and be like, oh, Schaub is better than Matt Ryan. I just do think it's fascinating with Schaub that last year he had in Houston where he threw all those pick sixes have somehow become the defining aspect of his career. And people look at him and say, oh, that's what he is. And that's what he was always going to be, rather than looking at him as currently a 36 year old quarterback that had a really bad year as a 32 year old. But that's not necessarily the defining aspect of his career. And the way I would sort of compare it is like you look at Matt Ryan's 32 year old season, which was this past year in 2017. Now imagine a scenario where Matt Ryan is just never any better than what he was this past year. And most people would be like, no, that's not going to happen. Matt Ryan's going to have, you know, ups and downs and good years and bad years over the next 5 to 7 years or whatever that he's in Atlanta. And of course you believe that because it makes perfect sense when you see it from that angle. But for some reason, people can't fathom that reality where it's like Matt Schaub. It's not to sit here and be like Matt Schaub's going to suddenly revert and become the version of player that he was when he was 28, when he led the NFL in passing. But it's not like he is what he is and he's always going to be that, you know, what he was at age 32, that he can't possibly be any better. And so I think the notion that Matt Schaub can't come over a short period of time and win the Falcons some games and keep them in playoff contention should they need it, and be an effective game manager and all that sort of thing. I don't really buy into that. I understand why people think that way. I just think it's very, very wrong and very, very limited viewpoint. I think the day the Falcons get rid of Matt Schaub, I think the plan is probably this is going to be Schaub's last year, whether he retires or whether the Falcons move on from him, we'll see. But I think the Falcons hope that between Kurt Binkert or Garrett Grayson, one of those guys plays well enough this summer that earns a spot as the third quarterback, whether that's on the roster or on the practice squad, but earns a spot there that gives them some hope that next year they can sort of turn the quarterback to keys to that guy and not necessarily have to go out and get a pricey veteran
to sort of fill that void. And I think that's the plan right now, but I don't see Schaub going anywhere. We got more questions to answer, but before we do, I want to plug LockedOnSports.com, the one-stop hub for the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find content related to the NBA, NFL, and Major League Baseball. Again, that's LockedOnSports.com, your team every day. So our next question comes from Riley Street. He says, not accounting for injuries, how long do you feel like our better players can play at a high level, and how long do you feel that they could play beyond that? Well, as a general rule of thumb, when you're, except for probably quarterback, kicker, and punter, which are generally the exceptions, most NFL positions tend to start to decline between the ages of 30 and 32. Running backs and safeties have a slightly shorter shelf life, so you might push that up a year or two. But it's usually because athleticism starts to deteriorate at that age, as well as the ability of the bodies, the ability of the body to recover from injuries. And from what I understand, I'm certainly not a trainer or a licensed medical professional, but what I understand is why you see a sharp drop from players' ability to play after the age of 30, for the most part in the NFL. And there's obviously exceptions to that, but it's because of that ability, that inability to recover from injuries quickly. And, you know, playing in the NFL, football is a very violent game, and you accumulate injuries over the course of the season, and your body just is not able to sort of fight through that and push through that at age 30, at age 31, in the same way that you are at age 25 and 26 and 27. So I guess for me, like, as an example of what I'm talking about, that's one of the reasons why, like, I sit here and be like, I don't know how many more peak seasons of Julio there are going to be, because he's going to be age 29 this year, and he might just have two more peak seasons, because all the nagging injuries that he's able to sort of gut through now and still be Julio at age 31, is he going to still be able to gut through those to the same degree? I don't know. And that's one of those things that I do wonder about a little bit. So to answer your question, rather than going through the entire roster, I would just say, just basically look at the roster and look at where, when they're going to be age 31 and subtract from there. And that's basically how many more quality seasons that they'll probably have. You know, obviously there are certain players that will play well beyond that. Centers, when you look at offensive linemen, centers tend to play longer than guards and tackles, just because it's less reliant on athleticism. It's than the tackle position in particular. Cornerbacks that are not only good athletes, but also have great technique and awareness and all those sorts of things. The Champ Baileys, the Charles Woodsons of the world, the Brent Grimeses of the world tend to last longer in the league than cornerbacks that just rely solely on their athleticism. So if I'm looking at guys like Trufant or Alford, I would say Alford is probably more likely to sort of decline earlier rather than Trufant. I think Trufant probably has a better chance of being able to prolong his career as a starter into at age 33, at age 34, like we saw with guys like Woodson and Champ Bailey, just because I think Trufant is a little bit more refined of a cornerback, while Alford, I think, tends to rely a little bit more on his athleticism than necessarily being the most refined cornerback. But that's not to suggest that he's like Dante Robinson and purely an athlete. And that was one of the reasons why Dante didn't last long here in Atlanta, because he had that ACL injury in Houston. And then as he got older, he just became less effective. Riley's next question is, what would you consider to be the ranking of the coordinators in the NFC South? Would you say any of them are on the fast track of becoming head coaches? Ranking them in terms of their ability, I don't know. I have no idea about that. But if we're just ranking them purely off of their, my, you know, the gambling odds that I would put on them to be head coaches in the near future, and if we're weighing the ability to be a college head coach equally with being a pro head coach, I would probably rank them Marquand Manuel number one. I would put Todd Monken, the Bucks offensive coordinator, number two. He was just recently the head coach of Southern Miss. Steve Sarkisian would be number three, just because I do think he could fairly easily, if he has a successful year here in Atlanta, could fairly easily get a decent head coaching gig in college. At, you know, whether it's Monken or Sark, they could probably get, at least probably tomorrow, could get a job as at a mid-major somewhere in college land. So maybe not at a Power 5 school, but four, I would probably put Pete Carmichael, the offensive coordinator for the Saints. Then I would sort of clump Mike Smith, Dennis Allen, and North Turner together, five, six, and seven. I'd probably put Mike Smith at the top of that, but barely, just because retread coaches tend to be out of fashion today. And so I would say Mike Smith probably has the best chance of those guys of being a head coach just because he was actually semi-successful rather than Dennis Allen was not very good in Oakland, and North Turner, you know, was had some good moments in with the Chargers, but for the rest of his career has been pretty awful as a head coach. Then last I would put Eric Washington just because even though the last two Carolina defensive coordinators, Sean McDermott and Steve Wilks, got head coaching gigs, so that would probably – but it's just Washington, you know, as a defensive line coach, I don't know if he's going to go – if Carolina's going to go 3-for-3 on that. But we'll see. Like, he could – I probably should put him 5 and put Smith, Allen, and Turner, you know, 6, 7, and 8. So that was probably how I would sort of rank him. And we got more to talk about with Riley and others' questions, but I do want to plug the Locked On NFL podcast with host Matt Williamson, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Okay, Riley's next question is, best NFL rivalries, any idea how the Falcons-Saints became such a big rivalry? Where did it start? I think the rivalries are all regional. So your first question, I don't really have an answer because it really all depends on where you live at. Because the weird thing about the NFL is there aren't really any sort of big national rivalries, or at least when they are, it's usually tied to those two teams being like the best. Like the Patriots-Colts rivalry in the Manning-Brady years was one of the big rivals. Or the Steelers-Ravens rivalry of a couple of years ago, back when those two teams were sort of vying for control of the AFC for a number of years. And, you know, that's still a big rivalry, but probably not as big a deal as today as it was, say, like 7 years ago, back when those teams were sort of at their sort of peaks. And so I think, you know, it's hard for these sort of national rivalries to develop in the NFL just because it's so much harder to sustain success, you know, particularly when you're not the Patriots, you know. And so it's one of these things where it's hard for these things to become consistent year in year. But you will get like 3 or 4 years where there'll be a big rivalry. Like I remember in the 90s, it was the 49ers and the Cowboys, back when those two teams, like the winner of that game in the postseason would go to the Super Bowl, and often it was the Cowboys. Then it sort of morphed into the 49ers and the Packers a little bit once the Cowboys sort of dipped in the era Brett Favre sort of rose to the top. But as for the Saints-Falcons rivalry, it's a big thing in the South, but in Iowa, I don't think anybody cares about it. You know, in Iowa, it might be Packers-Vikings, but down here, it's like, hey, you know, like Packers-Vikings, yeah, that's a thing, but like that's not a big deal. As for the history of the rivalry, you know, I actually did a little bit of research and I learned some things. Obviously, it started in the 60s when the Falcons joined the NFL in 1966. The Saints joined in 1967. The NFL was really trying to expand into the South to try to keep the AFL, the American Football League, from getting some teams there, and sort of got the Falcons and the Saints. What I did not realize was the first couple of years both teams were in the league, they were not in the same division. I always had assumed that they were in the NFC West to start, but they were in like the Coastal Division back before the pre-merger days, which clearly I don't know anything about the NFL pre-merger. I know the Falcons existed and that's about it. But yeah, once the merger happened in 1970, then they joined the NFC West with the 49ers and the Rams back when they were in L.A. I think a big part of why the rivalry sort of cemented not only is the regional things, but also because throughout the 1970s, the Rams were the dominant team in the division. And then throughout the 1980s, the 49ers were the dominant team in the division. So I think really the Falcons and the Saints were two teams that were basically competing with one another to not be the doormat in the division. They were always fighting over third place, so to speak. And so I think that really sort of solidified the rivalry beyond the sort of the regional thing. Justin Sandu asks, can you explain the different responsibilities of each player slash position for both the Falcons cover 3 and cover 1 scheme they play? Also, what situations do they tend to play each defense in, and how effective do you think they are? We'll start with the cover 1 because that's the simplest one. In a nutshell, cover 1 is a single high safety, Ricardo Allen in this case, patrols the middle of the field, prevents the deep ball. The Falcons play man coverage underneath. And, you know, generally speaking, I would say the Falcons will almost always deploy cover one with rare exceptions in on third downs on passing situations. Third down passing situation. I don't mean all passing situations. I mean like third and two, which basically if it's third and two or longer, it's almost always a passing situation. So they'll play cover one in those instances almost exclusively. There are exceptions, but and that's usually their main thing now. It was much more of a every down thing in 2016. We'll circle back and talk about some of the reasons why. Primarily, you know, obviously in man coverage, if all the guys up front are playing man coverage, it's pretty simple. Cover that guy, you cover that guy, you cover that guy. Primarily, the issue with cover one is the deep safety, and his job is primarily to not give up the big play, not let the ball go deep. He'll often shade to the side, like when teams go to their 3-by-1 sets, and the 3-by-1 set means that you have three wide receivers lined up on one side of the field and one wide receiver running to the other side of the field. He'll shade his coverage over to the side where the three receivers are, just because he generally has to give one of those guys more help. And so that's one way that teams can attack it, by saying, okay, he's going to shade over that side. We'll send the one guy deep and he'll be isolated one-on-one. Fortunately, the Falcons have good enough corners that usually isn't a huge, huge, massive problem. But obviously all the instances where you can think where Trufant or Alford got burned deep in the last couple of years, you know, it becomes a problem from time to time. But generally the responsibility is don't give up the big play, don't give up the long ball. And it's very effective. It's hard on that center fielder, but when you have good cover guys underneath, like the Falcons do, it makes the job so much more easier. And that's primarily how Ricardo Allen plays it. He's not necessarily like Earl Thomas. Like Earl Thomas is cheating. When they play cover one, he's cheating all the time. He's just basically like, I'm going to jump this route, I'm going to jump this route, I'm going to jump this route. And Earl Thomas, because he's Earl friggin' Thomas, can do that. But Ricardo Allen is more like, I'm not going to give up the big play. And I think that's one of the reasons why people tend to criticize him, is he tends to play it a little bit more safer, which I think makes a lot of sense, because he's not as talented as Earl Thomas. He's not as talented as some of these other guys. And, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword, to a certain extent. I think with the cover three, it's a little bit more complicated, but the simplest way I could try to explain it is, generally speaking, the Falcons will use this on less obvious passing downs. Like, for example, they'll use it in their base defense quite a bit. Again, this is a generalization. This is an oversimplification, and frankly, is flat out wrong what I'm about to say. But as a sort of general simplified way of thinking at it, you can think about, oh, the Falcons use a cover three primarily on base defense, on base downs, which is 35% of their defense, and they use cover one primarily on a nickel, which is 65% of the defense. Again, that's not factually true, but as a simple way of, you know, Justin and any of you other guys to sort of wrap around your head about how and why the Falcons use it, that's the simplest way I can sort of show it to you. Cover three is basically where you have three deep defenders, each with responsibility to the one third of the deep field. You have the free safety again, Ricardo Allen roaming the middle, but you have the outside corners, Trufant and Alford in this instance, and maybe Oliver in the future, having deep responsibility as well. It's a zone defense, unlike cover one, which is a man defense. But the zone defense can often, particularly for the outside corners, morph into more of a man defense when players run. You know, that's part of the whole idea of zone, is like if a guy runs into your zone, it becomes man. And, you know, that's one way that teams attack zone defenses quite a bit, is that they overload zones and send two guys into that guy's zone and he can only cover one guy. But like basically with the cover three, the deep responsibility, those guys split evenly the deep thirds and prevent the deep ball. Underneath, you only have four defenders. And so one of the issues with the cover three is it's a little vulnerable to underneath. Typically, you have the weak side linebacker, the outside linebackers, weak side and strong side linebacker. They each cover the flat. They cover one flat of the field, which is the underneath area on the outside, outside the tackles, where they often are asked to cover tight ends or shallow wide receivers or running backs or whatnot. Then the middle linebacker sort of covers the middle of the field, the middle zone, in the middle. So he basically has to cover everything between the hashes or between the numbers, similar to the free safety. So it puts a lot of responsibility on the middle linebacker. So you need a good middle linebacker to play it. And then the strong safety is sort of the rover that sort of basically covers an intermediate zone, typically down the seam on whatever side of the field that the tight end is on. That's typically, and he can sort of help out the middle linebacker, help out the outside linebacker to help sort of keep the middle of the field from being overly exploited. And that's one of the weaknesses of the cover three, which is it typically can be attacked over the intermediate area, but behind the linebackers and underneath the free safety over the middle. And that's typically where you need your sort of strong safety to basically be your bulwark. But that's one of the reasons why you can play it, because if you have fast guys underneath, fast rangy guys, and that's one of the reasons why the Falcons are so covetous, as they might say, of speed with their linebackers, is that you kind of need fast guys to be able to cover all that space, because you have one less defender than, say, a team that plays cover two, where you have five underneath defenders with only two guys playing deep responsibilities. So one of the other areas that you kind of need to be a successful cover three scheme, and this is why the Seahawks were so successful running it and the Falcons haven't been as successful running it, is you need to be able to get pressure with four guys, because you're often only sending four guys because you need the other guys to drop and cover their zones. And the Falcons have not been that great at getting pressure with four guys. And that was a big reason why they made the switch from cover three primarily at the beginning of 2016 to almost exclusively cover one by the last month of that season. Part of that was because the rookies were not really understanding what their zones are. The Falcons still aren't really a great zone team with, given the youth on their defense. They're better, certainly much better than they were at the start of 2016. But, you know, they're not great in zone. They have fast guys, but they don't have necessarily what, shall we say, smart guys at a lot of the spots, or not a lot of the spots, or some of the spots on their defense. And so that can sort of get them in trouble when it comes to playing zone from time to time. But, you know, you go back to Dan Quinn's years in Seattle, where Bennett and Averill and those guys were at their sort of peak in 2013, 2014. They were very good playing zone, because like the ball was going to come out quick, because it's like, especially with Michael Bennett, he was like, he's going to wreck you. He's like, you go back, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but if you go back and watch that Patriots Seahawks Super Bowl, almost every, it seems like every single snap Michael Bennett's hitting Tom Brady on that game, and so the ball has to come out quick. And so that's one of the reasons why I still have questions about this Falcons defense making that big step, because to me, until they can get pressure reliably with four guys, there always is going to be a little bit of a ceiling on how good this defense can be. And I think a lot of people tend to focus on Ricardo Allen and his inability to make the big plays that Earl Thomas makes as like the thing that's holding back the defense. And I just disagree. I think it's really being able to pressure with four guys. You know, to me, the biggest knock on Ricardo Allen is he's not good enough to cover up for other people's mistakes, essentially. And that's really where he got a lot of blame, particularly early on in 2016, when the rookies were just not playing particularly well. And Keanu Neal, Deion Jones, Campbell, all those guys. And he just wasn't good enough to cover up for their mistakes. And he got a lot of blame for some of the big plays that the Falcons gave up over those first six, seven games of the year. To me, that's one of the reasons why I'm like, yeah, the Falcons pass rush is the key to success. And, you know, the linebackers being a little bit better with the awareness might help a little bit with the cover three stuff. They played a lot more cover three last year. I think they sort of did the opposite transition, which was cover one early and then more cover three by the end of the year. I don't know how much injuries had to do with that and other things, certain matchups. But yeah, I think that's basically you know what I'll do? I'll put a link to some articles that show, like there's one that shows a good breakdown of that play that Tevin Coleman had against the Seahawks, where the Shanahan in 2016 dialed up a good play to attack the zone in cover three. I'll also post one, a good article from Locked On Patriots from this past January that shows some concepts that are good at attacking the cover three. And you can find those in the show notes at falcfans.com. And that's it, guys. Those are all the questions. I appreciate everybody that's sending in their questions. Again, if you want to add your questions, as I said at the top of the show, you can do it on Twitter at Falcfans or Locked On Falcons. You can do so on Facebook, Locked On Falcons. The email address is LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. And of course, you can leave a comment at LockedOnFalcons.com or FalcFans.com, where the show is posted daily. So appreciate everybody sending the questions. We'll be back Monday, I think, with a fan talk, another fan talk. And we've got a Foye Olukun scouting report coming next week as well. And we'll see what else we have to talk about. The Falcons did OTAs this week. I don't know if there was a whole lot for me to glean from it. And maybe you guys thought some things emerged, some interesting things emerged from it. But it seems to be business as usual as far as I'm concerned. So not a whole lot to talk about other than just sort of talking in circles, which I want to do. So until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.